This is VOA News. I'm Laurel Bowman. Voters in the U.S. state of Nevada cast ballots Saturday for their preferred Democratic Party candidates, hoping to defeat U.S. Republican President Donald Trump in November's national election. The Nevada caucuses are the third contest for the Democratic presidential hopefuls, following those in Iowa and New Hampshire. Unlike those two states with overwhelmingly white populations, Nevada is far more ethnically diverse. Results in Nevada, home to the country's gambling mecca of Las Vegas, could start trickling in a few hours after voting starts. Now for the latest on the coronavirus, which started in China. Here's Edward Barron for Reuters.
China reported a sharp decrease in new deaths and cases of the coronavirus on Saturday, but a doubling of infections in South Korea and fresh cases in Iran is adding to unease about its rapid spread and global reach. Mainland China had 397 new confirmed cases of coronavirus infections on Friday, down from 889 a day earlier. Iran, South Korea, Italy, and Lebanon are worsening, though. This has prompted a warning from the World Health Organization that the window of opportunity to contain the international spread is closing. South Korea has spiked to 229 new confirmed cases, taking its tally to 433. Officials warned that could rise substantially, as more than 1,000 people who attended a church at the center of the outbreak had shown flu-like symptoms. Iran, which had no reported cases earlier this week, saw 10 new cases, one of which had died, taking the number to 28 infections and 5 deaths.
That was Edward Barron reporting for Reuters. This is VOA News. Former South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has been sworn in as vice president, sealing a peace deal aimed at ending 6 years of civil war. President Salva Kiir witnessed the moment at a ceremony at the State House in the capital, Juba. It is hoped that the new unity government will bring an end to the conflict that has killed about 400,000 people and displaced millions. U.S. billionaire Warren Buffett is telling investors to be wary of Wall Street advice when it comes to deals. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
In his annual letter to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders, Buffett maintains the current system of reviewing deals almost always favors the deal that corporate CEOs propose. He writes, taking such advice is a bit like asking the barber whether you need a haircut. Buffett suggests companies consider hiring two sets of advisors, one to argue for and one against a deal before moving forward. But he adds, don't hold your breath awaiting this reform. The current system, whatever its shortcomings for shareholders, works magnificently for CEOs and the many advisors and other professionals who feast on deals. I'm Ben Thomas.
The CEO of Britain's Ryanair is being criticized for singling out Muslim men as threats. The AP's Zariah Shackley reports.
Ryanair chief executive Michael O'Leary is facing criticism for suggesting Muslim men should be singled out for extra scrutiny at airports. The boss of the Irish budget carrier told Saturday's Times of London that families with young children shouldn't be subjected to airport security checks because there is zero chance of them being bombers. He said terrorists will generally be males of a Muslim persuasion. The Muslim Council of Britain called the comments racist and discriminatory. Talmama, a charity that monitors hate incidents against Muslims, said O'Leary's flippant comments could harm Ryanair's business. O'Leary has a history of provocative remarks that keep Ryanair's name in the headlines. I'm Zariah Shackley in London.
U.S. federal regulators have approved a new drug to help lower cholesterol. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Millions of people take statins to help lower LDL cholesterol to ward off heart attacks. But for some, they don't work. For others, there are side effects like muscle pain. Now, the Food and Drug Administration has approved Nexletol, a daily pill made by Esperion Therapeutics, which works differently than other drugs to block an enzyme that helps form cholesterol. Studies show Nexletol can lower bad cholesterol by about 25% when taken alone and by 43% when combined with a statin like Lipitor or Crestor. Nexletol is expected to hit the market in late March. The cost is thought to be about $300 a month. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We want to believe that our partner in the agreement, that is the president, will keep his word, will make sure that the security of the opposition leaders are in place, and that nothing else will come in between to distract us.
Dr. Riek Machar is now the South Sudanese First Vice President after an installation ceremony Saturday.
The police are coming in and they are casting their report. There's no violence, there's no injury, there's no altercation between voters from different parties.
Togolese vote in a presidential election Saturday.
We believe that when the right hand comes or when the prime minister is feeling well, he'll obviously present himself before court. And
the Lesotho police say they plan to charge Prime Minister Thomas Tabane with murder for his role in the death of his wife. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Dr. Riek Machar, the leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in Opposition, or SPLMIO, has been installed as the South Sudanese First Vice President in the capital, Juba, Saturday. The swearing-in forms part of the revitalized peace agreement for the formation of a transitional government. Meanwhile, some South Sudanese are expressing concern about the bloated size of the transitional government, saying it will be difficult for their community economy to fund it. For reaction to the swearing in of Dr. Riek Machar as part of the implementation of the peace agreement, I reached Manasseh Zindo, the SPLMIO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports.
The swearing in of Dr. Riek Machar as the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan in the revitalized transitional government of national unity has taken place in Juba, also sworn with him, three other vice presidents. This is a step in the right direction. It is part of the commitment that we've made towards the full implementation of the revitalizer agreement. I hope that now that he's been sworn in as the first vice president, together with President Salva Kiir, they will be able to form a new government and we can begin to implement the remaining critical issues of the revitalizer agreement.
Next week, it is expected that the rest of members of the government, of the transitional government, would also be assembled next week as part of the process. What are your expectations?
That is the expectation. You know, the last time we talked, the number of states had been reduced to 10, which means the 32 governors who were there had been removed from office. So we expect now 10 governors to be appointed to the 10 states, and then also the formation of the revitalized agreement, which is the appointment of the cabinet ministers. We hope this could take place soon so that we can have a whole government in place for the implementation of the revitalized agreement.
Well, one of the key demands of the SPLMIO is for the security arrangements to be dealt with accordingly. Are you satisfied with the process so far now that the first vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, has been sworn in?
We are not satisfied. It is a matter of concern to us. And as a leader, Dr. Riek Machar took the word of the president that the president will personally ensure that the opposition leaders are safe and that their security are granted. We will hold the president to his word, and we hope now that we will have a new government in place, it can enable us to look for the funds which is needed for the training of the unified force and their deployment so that the country can be safe and everyone can feel that their security has been catered for.
Talking about funds, some South Sudanese are saying the transitional government appears to be too big. Where will the money come from to pay these members of this government, as well as take care of the needs of the ordinary South Sudanese?
What is your response to that?
It is true that we are going to have a very bloated government. It is part of the compromise that we needed to do so that we can have peace in the country. If having a bloated government can bring peace and stability to the country, so be it. My understanding is that the resources that the country has and the revenue which the country has been generating from the oil and the other revenues, if well utilized, it could cater for this bloated government, and we could stabilize the country within 3 years. After 3 years, we could conduct an election so that the election can bring in a linear government and a government now that can be able to use the funds available sufficiently for the development of the country.
Talking about peace, will the SPLM-IO, now part of the government, assure the people of South Sudan that with this formation of this transitional government, peace will be restored and that the process will be followed until the three-year window that you spoke about to ensure a credible election so South Sudanese will choose their next leaders?
The SPLM-IO can assure the people of South Sudan and the world at large that we will do everything possible politically to make sure that everything goes as planned. As you can see, we are walking into the government now with the reservations about the security. But we want to believe that our partner in the agreement, that is the president, will keep his word, will make sure that the security of the opposition leaders are in place, and that nothing else will come in between to distract us from implementation of the security arrangement, the implementation of the critical issues that we need so that we can have a safe country.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Meanwhile, in neighboring Sudan, the transitional government is expected to release a report next month on the June 3 crackdown on democracy protesters. An investigation committee found that at least 87 people were killed and 100 injured when the security forces violently cleared a months-long sit-in around the army headquarters. At least 25 protesters are still missing, as Mohamed Alamin reports from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum.
The last time 64-year-old Rawda Abdelgadir Bakhid saw her 26-year-old son Fadl was a few days before the Muslim holy months of Ramadan. Fadl was one of thousands of young people joining a months-long sit-in outside Sudan's army headquarters in Khartoum demanding democracy. Where Ramadan ended June 3rd, though Sudan's security forces violently broke up the sit-in and Fadl disappeared. I don't know why he was the only one to go missing around his colleagues, friends and neighbors, Bakhid says, because a lot of them were going back and forth to the sit-in. The Central Committee of the Sudanese Doctors said as troops cleared protest area, they killed at least 100 protesters and injured 400. The group says 40 bodies were pulled from the Nile River, where they had been dumped by security forces. Sudanese authorities say 87 people were killed. Tens of protesters, like Bakhid's son Fadl, went missing. Some of the missing protesters were found alive by an investigative committee formed by the main protest group, the Sudanese Professional Association. SPA spokesman Muhammad Nagil Assam says the survivors are under intensive treatment before they plan to give their testimony. After long efforts, their campaign found 15 of the missing, 5 of them dead, he says. They found 10 others alive, says Al-Assam, but they were tortured and some have wounds or other psychological problems. 8 months later, at least 25 of the missing protesters have not been found. Relatives of the missing fear their bodies may have been lost in the River Nile or disappeared by security services. Sudan's transitional government formed an investigative committee to track down the missing. Fadih Khalafallah, a member of that committee, says, more worryingly, 4 more protesters have gone missing since December. She says they are doing their best to find the missing persons. There are more opportunities to enter the morgues recently than in the past months, says Khalaf. They started doing DNA tests. She says to check bodies in the morgues. Relatives of the missing, like Bakhid, can only hope and pray that their loved ones have gone into hiding or are being held by security. She believes deeply that Hassan Fadul is alive but detained somewhere, she says. He would never disappear from home this whole time. If he died, says Bakhid, for sure we would know. I pray for him every night, she says. Relatives hope to get some answers when the committee released its report next month. Mohammed Alamin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The people of Togo choose a new president in an election across the country Saturday. Incumbent President Faure Gnassingbé is being challenged by Jean-Pierre Fabre, a human rights campaigner and a former journalist, and Gabriel Agbayome Kodjo, a former prime minister. Supporters of the president say he will be re-elected because of a divided opposition. However, both opposition candidates express confidence to win the election. For the latest development, I reach VOA's French to Africa reporter Irene Hungbo, who is in Togo to cover the presidential election.
Polling station opened at 7 local time here in Lomé. There were a long queue outside some station. 3.6 million voters are being called to the poll until 4 p.m. local time in about 9,000 polling stations across the country. For now, there's no major incident, according to the most of the observers that I spoke to since this morning. I'm talking especially about the African Union observers, as well as ECOWAS and the community of Sahel, Saharan state. They are all on the ground monitoring this Togolese vote.
How are people voting so far? I understand there's no violence and that people are comporting themselves well in this voting process. You have visited some polling stations. What is the current situation on the ground?
Everything is going smoothly up to now. As you already say, there's no violence. People are coming in and go, coming in and go. The first two opposition candidates, former Prime Minister Kodjo Agbayome and ANC party president Jean-Pierre Fabre, have voted right after fulfilling their civic duty. They both indicate on their side that they will win the election. Kodjo Agbayome went even far, already warning against any attempt for the fraud. But I can assure you that there's really not a very large crowd in the city, at least up to now. The population might come out later, as they have until 4 p.m. local time to cast their vote. But up to now, everything seems to be perfect.
Well, we understand there was a report of ballot stuffing, and officials of the CNE or the Electoral Commission came to try to resolve it, took the stuffed ballot away and brought a new one. People are wondering what happened to the ballot box that was stuffed and taken away. What happens to it?
I heard about that report, but I don't have a full detail for now to give you about what happened. I did approach some observer from African Union, from ECOWAS, to hear about what they know on this report. Themselves don't have any detail to share for now, but they promised to get back to us as soon as they have more detail on it that I can share with you, Peter.
What did the CNE, the Electoral Commission, say about when they plan to release the results of this presidential election?
Peter, it could be tonight, it could be tomorrow or after tomorrow. But overall, the Electoral National Independent Commission has 6 days to release the result. If no candidate obtains at least 50% of the vote, the first two will compete in the second round 15 days after the result of the first round.
Well, what are some of these opposition leaders talking about? The credibility of the election, were there any warnings from them, even when they claim that they have the support to take over from the president, Faure Gnassingbé?
The first two opposition candidates, the former Prime Minister Kodjo Agbeyome and ANC Party President Jean-Pierre Fabre has voted. Right after fulfilling their civic duty, they both indicate on their side that they will win the election. Kodjo Agbeyome went even further, already warning against any attempt for fraud. But I can assure you that there is really not a very large crowd in the city, at least up to now. The population might come out later, as they have until 4 p.m. local time to cast the vote.
So far, what have you been hearing from the poll observers that you've spoken to about how the voting went on today?
Like I was saying earlier, everything seemed to be on a good track up to now. What I'm telling you is exactly what observers are telling us here on the ground. Togolese are coming in and go, they are casting their vote. There's no violence, there's no injury, there's no altercation between voters from different parties. So everything seemed to be on the good way. We hope to have the same, to be seeing the same thing up to 4 p.m. Where polling station will be closed.
Irena Hongbo is a reporter with VOA's French to Africa service. She spoke with me from the Togolese capital, Lomé. The Deputy Commissioner of the Lesotho Police says Prime Minister Dr. Thomas Tabani will be charged when he returns from his medical trip abroad. Paseka Moketi says the Prime Minister will face justice for the role he played in the murder of his estranged wife. His comments come after the Prime Minister failed to show up in court to hear charges against him. The police say the Prime Minister's lawyer informed them about Dr. Tabani's trip to South Africa, where he is seeking medical attention to an undisclosed ailment. Deputy Police Commissioner Paseka Moketi tells me the Prime Minister will be given enough time as he seeks medical attention before making a decision whether to issue an arrest warrant against him.
Well, the Prime Minister did not officially explain the reason why he did not show up. Safe to say, we were given the sick leave, which was handed in by his lawyer, and which we doubt its veracity, of course. However, it's valid for about 7 days from today, the 21st of February to 27th of February. So it means immediately after that, we expect him to appear before the court of law to be formally charged.
Doesn't the Prime Minister enjoy some form of immunity while in office?
No, not at all. He doesn't enjoy any immunity. The person who enjoys the immunity is the king, who is our constitutional monarch, the one who is immune from any criminal suit.
I understand the Prime Minister has gone to neighboring South Africa to seek medical attention. The reason why he did not show up for proceedings today, if he returns, will the charges you would prefer against him proceed?
No, the charges not proceed because he has to physically appear before the court of law and the charges has to be read in his presence.
And what are the charges against him?
There are three charges. One, murder of his former wife, or late wife, rather. Secondly, the attempted murder of the person who was with his wife at the time when she was gunned down. And the last one is the malicious damage to property, because the vehicle that they were traveling in was destroyed during the shooting.
What do you say to critics or his supporters who are saying these charges appear to be politically motivated just to bring him down as the Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Lesotho?
No. I always dismiss that statement as nonsensical, because, one, the lady, his own wife was gunned down. And the question is, who are responsible for the murder of his own wife? If the charges are politically motivated, at least somebody must say, so-and-so is the one who is responsible for the murder of this particular person, but the police are targeting a different person altogether. Actually, the Prime Minister is tasked under the common purpose doctrine, where he participated, but not directly is the one who pulled the trigger.
When he appears in court and the charges are read against him, What is the next step forward in terms of the judicial process?
When the trial actually resumes, he will be entitled to apply for a recusal of the judge or the presiding officer, whom, in his opinion, will think that will not be impartial enough. Well, that is constitutional right, but we believe that he's entitled to assess that right.
So what has been the message that the police in Lesotho have been sending to the people in the country following the no-show of the Prime Minister, giving the explanation that he has to seek medical attention in South Africa?
Well, it happens always that a person who has to appear before the court of law may actually submit either to the court or to the police that he's not actually feeling well. Sometimes we may come lenient to allow him to get well so that when he's able to stand for his trial or to be charged, that can be done. So we believe that when the right time comes or when the Prime Minister is feeling well, he'll obviously present himself before court and be formally charged.
What if the accused is playing a waiting game and that probably he or she might have perhaps something that prevents him from being prosecuted? Will the process still continue, if I may ask you?
Well, the process will still continue, but you know, what I know can exonerate somebody from being prosecuted is only when he's suffering from mental illness, which actually prevents him or her not to comprehend the nature of the charges he's facing. Other diseases actually are not treated for by our law.
Paseka Moketi is the Deputy Commissioner of the Lesotho Police. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. An exhibition showcasing the life of former South African President Nelson Mandela has been launched in Johannesburg. Organizers say the exhibition that is set to tour different countries is aimed at encouraging public good through showcasing the selfless life of Mandela. Thusa Komalo reports from Johannesburg.
The exhibition of Mandela My Life, the official exhibition, features a variety of pictures of Mandela stretching throughout his life. It also has personal belongings like his blanket, clothes, pair of shoes, and boxing gloves. Piecing together various artifacts of the exhibition provides an undiluted chronology of Mandela's life as a child, a villager, a lawyer, a boxer, an activist, a prisoner, a president, and a retired struggling icon. Selo Hatang, CEO of the Mandela Foundation, told VOA that the exhibition has already been to New Zealand and Australia.
I'm hoping that throughout we will be people who will, they say, not in my name will we deny that apartheid was never a crime against humanity. Not in my name will parliamentarians and politicians play around with gender-based violence. Not in my name that another woman and another child will be abused. And not in our name that we will be a nation that continues to not care about the most vulnerable.
The Johannesburg exhibition, which is taking place in the Mandela Square in Sandton, is attracting local and international visitors. Dileka Mandela, one of Mandela's granddaughters, has also been there.
You can see they dug deep into what granddad like. It's amazing the effect that granddad has outside the country. I mean, the world over, he's still revered. He's like an onion. You peel every layer, you find something else, and you go to another layer, there's something else. And certain exhibition can pick out a certain aspect of his life and then showcase that, even from country to country.
Linda van Beek is one of the ordinary South Africans who toured the exhibition on the first day, Thursday.
Nelson Mandela was a legacy in himself, and I think it's just important that we do keep him alive. At the exhibition, there's a lot of who he was as an individual, not just as a politician. So I was very excited to actually come through and see the exhibition and see all the little personal touches that they had put together, and I think it's incredible.
From Johannesburg, the exhibition will go to Cape Town before heading to other countries. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, is calling on President Edgar Lungu to address the nation to outline plans to resolve what it says is the ongoing murder of school children. The party says there appears to be a surge in the use of chemicals by criminals in the gassing of school children. This after police announced an investigation into the murder of what they say are the killing of innocent citizens. But Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, says it is regrettably unfortunate that the president has yet to address the nation to assure citizens of his administration's effort to stop the killings.
There have been silence from the government, especially the president, in the midst of crisis. We have a situation where suspected ritual killers are using chemicals for gassing people. A lot of lives have been lost. The people have lost confidence in the state police, and now they have taken the law in their hands, and whoever is suspected to be a ritual killer is being burnt alive, killed by the instant justice mob. And in the midst of that crisis, which has spread throughout the country, the government appears to be silent. And this is not very surprising for us in Zambia, because since President Edgar Lungu came into power almost 6 years ago, he has avoided press conferences. He has only held one press conference since he came to power 6 months ago. It's a vacuum of information. People are taking the law in their own hands, and it is surely more speculation. And government is sitting on information and not giving it to the people.
The police, I understand, are investigating the current ongoing situation about the gassing and the mob attack in order to bring the perpetrators to book. Isn't this enough?
Well, they've been investigating, but they've kept the investigations, the information to themselves. In fact, this problem started October last year, but some of the suspects that were apprehended in October last have not been taken to court. And that is what is infuriating the public, that the police are hiding the suspect. They should have explained to them what is going on, but they haven't done that. And because of that pressure, it was fueling the speculation that the state is involved, that this the whole thing has been sponsored by the state. And just today, some of the suspects, because of the pressure that is being mounted, some of the suspects were taken to court today, and they happen to be members of the ruling party. And this is why people now think that the government has been quiet. And because they were quiet, all they were doing is to try to implicate the opposition leaders as the one that are responsible for gassing people.
Supporters of the government have rejected criticism that it has been silent, and that this is yet another attempt by the opposition to scope cheap political points instead of helping with the security agencies to arrest those perpetrators or masterminds of this dastardly act.
Well, the opposition has been talking, have been holding press conferences, telling people the little information that we know about what is going on, and urging the government to do something about it. But because we are hitting against the people, then we, of course, it is just natural that we think the government is trying to hide something. And that is why the public is getting agitated, why the government is hiding the information. It is in the interest of the public that they know what is going on. Right now, these same people that are gassing the public have resorted to gassing schools. A lot of children have been gassed, and they have been they've ended up in hospital, and nobody is given an explanation. So that is infuriating the Zambian people. And when the opposition speaks on behalf of the Zambian people, they think that we are not helping the government.
Well, some people are indeed saying you are not helping in the government. You are only criticizing when the issue at hand is a national emergency issue that a government is dealing with, and that you criticizing the government that it has been silent and that it wants to blame the opposition for what is going on right now is unfortunate and unpatriotic. Your response to that?
The government under this crisis should have told us, of the people that they've already arrested, what are these things? Who has sent them? Of the chemicals that have been found, what are these chemicals? Where are they manufactured in the world? That information should be very, very, very simple to find out. If those chemicals have been tested, what are the results of the test? And why are they taking long to take the suspects to court? All those questions remain unanswered. And that is why we in the opposition are mounting pressure on the government to tell us something.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A two-day international conference on the implementation of the National Land Information System ended in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, Friday. Organized by the Ugandan Government Housing and Urban Development and supported by the World Bank, the theme of the conference was Global Modernization of Land Administration, Making Your Land Information Systems a Success. Officials say that over 20 African countries discussed at the conference how to adopt and emulate Uganda's experience, innovation, and successes to modernize land administration to transform African economies. For more about the conference, I read Christophe Dekin, General Manager of IGNFI.
This conference is aiming to celebrate the end of the deployment of the National Land Information System all over Ugandan territory. So the objective was during this conference to describe in detail all what has been done during this project, all the various components of the project. It was aimed to debate on future development once this system in its current state has been deployed, and a lot of exchange with other countries' representatives, which were invited to that conference to exchange views, experience, and to discuss about the way forward in their own countries.
Talking about the way forward, let's look at lessons from Uganda's experience in terms of modernizing land administration to transform African economies.
The first lesson learned is that such a system can be deployed and it is working. It is operated by the ministry staff who 10 years ago were used to manual procedures and now they are operating by themselves. They have appropriate systems. So the lesson learned is that also techniques is not the only issue to develop such a system. Human resources to be devoted to that system is very important. The infrastructure has to be suitable for the system to work. You know, it's a web-based system. Yes, that's worked all over the countries. And moreover, all the communications and public awareness around all this project is very important. So the lessons learned is that if we take into account all those components in the development of such a system, it works and it brings a lot, of course, to stabilize the growth of the economy, because every sector of economic growth is based on land tenure has to be secured land, reduced fraud and corruption, increased revenues are the advantage of such a system, and of course it benefits to African countries' growth in general.
Now, so how does this land information system work or operate?
It has been deployed into the 21 MZOs, the zone of office of Uganda, so which is a computerized system, and now every user, every citizen can go to its own district and have the system is offering the full range of services to him, which relates to the land they own. So, of course, it reduced the time of those operations. It has reduced from, you know, more than a tenth of days to a few days, even a few hours for such transactions. So all this speed up the economy by securing, accelerating all these services around land. And so this is really a basic ground for economic growth for every sector. Land has to be secured for economic sector to develop, whatever it is.
So what feedback have you gotten so far since the implementation of this in Uganda?
Very positive. However, a lot of things still need to be done, because even the system is existing, it's a secured system, it's working, but only 20% of the Ugandan territory is registered and is titled. So it means, and it's 80% of the land, which is mainly on customary land, are still to be integrated progressively into the system so that Uganda can be fully operating the system and taking full benefits of it. So there is still a huge work of land survey, adjudication works, and integration into the system. So we have all the basic with the system working. It creates a lot of benefits, but still a lot to do.
So what are the next steps across Africa in terms of monitoring it, in terms of implementing these measures in other African countries as well? What are the next steps?
I think that, the next step is that Uganda, first of all, it has demonstrated that it's covering the investment. So it means it's worth doing the investment. And so this is a basic element for all of the countries to have the same initiative. Because at the beginning, with many donors were not knowing exactly if it would be cost covering. It is covering the investment. So this is, I think, the main lessons learned. And so I think through such seminar and discussions with donors, any country could initiate more securely such initiatives. And I'm sure within the 10, 20 next years, I think most of the African countries should get similar system, which will be a real, very big step for their economy, security and growth.
Christophe Dekane is the general manager of IGNFI. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Tanasha featuring Diamond Platnumz with Gere. Yemi Alade follows with Lai Lai. Amre Diab with Neil Air. Makoma will follow with Natamboli. And then KC ends it with Limpopo. Kenya na kufanya umewe.
but you know I got you. One low, one designer, but you know I got you. One low, a Range Rover, you know I got you. Alemano, Dubai for summer, but you know I got you. Look, I got you. Chilling like OBO, but one day we gonna do it, do it, do it.
أنا وإنت حبيبي مفيش حاجة نقولها، واصلين لدرجة حب محدش في الدنيا وصلها. أنا ليك وعمري ما أكون يا حبيبي غير ليك روحي شغلها. دي الثانية وإنت بعيد إزاي قلبي هيستحملها. ازاي قلبي هيستحملها
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Desta Wandirad, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, he who does not mend his clothes will soon have none. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.